Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Pound for pound, a troll caught king salmon is the most valuable fish in Alaska. It's possible that a king salmon is more valuable to Alaska than a barrel of crude oil.
Uncertainty remains for a valuable Southeast Alaska king salmon fishery. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 4th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a trial in Ketchikan questions the constitutionality of tribal values posted in schools.
These values take on a meaning which are social and customary for these people, and it has taken on that meaning for the last 12,000 years.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
Since late last year, residents of Unalakleet have had to boil water because of problems with the city's aging water system. As KNOM's Greg Knight reports, the state of Alaska's Village Safe Water Program is preparing to connect the community to a new water source this summer.
The House Community and Regional Affairs Committee took testimony on Tuesday regarding the Village Safe Water Program. The program assists rural communities in developing sustainable water delivery and sanitation facilities. According to Carrie Bohan, the Facilities Services Program Manager at the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, Unalakleet will see work to improve conditions on its water system.
We are developing a new water source in Unalakleet and also replacing the entire drinking water distribution system. It's one of the oldest distribution systems, and it's also one of the largest communities that we serve.
Unalakleet has been dealing with freeze-ups of their water tank for years. In late 2001, freezing rain led to a frozen pool of standing water that shifted the community's pump house, dropping the flow of water into the water tank. Unalakleet is currently under a boil water notice, which is a predicament the city has faced since late last year. Mayor Abel Razzo says the city's aging water system has developed leaks, and Typhoon Murbach did not help the situation.
We have been under boil water notice since November. It was kind of the result of some catastrophic leaks that we had in the system, as well as the storm. We have had drinking water supplied to us through outside entities who donated bottled water to the native village of Unalakleet and to the city, which we have worked at distributing to all of our neighbors here in town.
According to the native village of Unalakleet, the Bureau of Indian Affairs has been donating the bottled water since the boil notice took effect. Razzo adds that the boil notice should expire in about a month, and building a new water source and piping will put an end to the yearly cycle of distribution system failures. This summer, Razzo says Norton Sound Health Corporation will assist the city with treating the water once the boil notice ends.
We've been partnering with the Village Safe Water Program now for, I think, over a year. And from what I understand, in the meetings that we've had so far, we'll be breaking ground on connecting the new water source to town this summer. The expected completion date of that project of connecting the new wells, which have already been dug, and upgrading our current water system to process the water coming in should be the end of next summer.
In Western Alaska, according to DEC, just more than half of the residents of Gamble and Wales are served by clean water systems, while less than 50% of those in Diomede, Shishmaref, Stebbins, Teller, and Wales have access to a safe water delivery system. Reporting in Nome, I'm Greg Knight.
A federal judge in Washington state issued a ruling this week that threatens to shut down trolling for king salmon in Southeast Alaska this summer. The ruling comes in a lawsuit filed 3 years ago by a Washington-based conservation group called Wild Fish Conservancy that aims to protect a small population of orcas. The lawsuit centers on whether Alaska fishermen should be allowed to harvest king salmon, which are considered essential prey for the southern resident killer whales. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has been following the lawsuit from Sitka in the heart of the southeast salmon troll fishing region and joins us now. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Casey.
Real quick, this ruling this week means king salmon fishing could get shut down this summer. Will it get shut down? Do we know?
We don't really know. If you look at the order, the language of the order says, yes, they're definitely calling for the end of troll fishing this summer. But both the state and the Alaska Trollers Association, who are interveners in this lawsuit, filed a notice to appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court. And they'll probably ask for a stay of the order until the appeal is heard. So it's possible that fishing might happen this summer. It's still kind of an open question, though.
Yeah. And I take it that uncertainty is pretty difficult for fishermen trying to just get ready for the season or to know if they should get ready for the season. I want to talk more about what the impacts might be to the fleet, but first, maybe let's back up. Where did this lawsuit come from? What does it aim to do?
Well, it all got real back in December of 2022 when another U.S. District Court judge in Western Washington named Judge Michelle Peterson issued a report and recommendation that basically went in favor of just about everything the Wild Fish Conservancy was asking for. The Wild Fish Conservancy, in its lawsuit, had argued that the National Marine Fisheries Service had violated sections of the Endangered Species Act and the National Environmental Policy Act in failing to fully account for the impact of Alaska's Chinook fishery on this very seriously threatened population of killer whales in Puget Sound. So that report and recommendation had to be affirmed by another U.S. District Court judge. And that happened this Tuesday when Judge Richard A. Jones basically issued the two-page order saying, this is it. And I'm ordering the National Marine Fisheries Service to fix the flaws. And I'm also vacating this document that's called an incidental take statement. And an incidental take statement is essential to open a fishery that might impact an endangered species. And so this ITS, or incidental take statement, that allows Chinook fishing to happen in southeast Alaska in summertime and in winter has been vacated.
So obviously this is focused on king salmon off Alaska's coast, but the orcas also spend a lot of time closer to Seattle, which is a huge city. It continues to grow. There have got to be other environmental factors going on there. So what are people saying about that?
Well, everybody keeps coming back to this, Casey, including our congressional delegation. They all issued statements saying this lawsuit is outrageous, mainly in that it overlooks what probably are the real threats to southern resident killer whales, which are industrial toxins, population of the Puget Sound area, vessel traffic, all these other sources that probably are creating more harm for these animals than the harvest of what is actually very few fish in southeast Alaska. I mean, the 2023 troll harvest allocation is only 149,000 kings. We're not talking millions of fish that are being scooped up in Alaska.
And I guess, I mean, whether that sways the judge or the Wild Fish Conservancy, who knows? But I think what's fair to say is that if that fishery gets shut down, it's going to have a huge impact on those people and their families. What have you heard from them about that? I mean, what's the impact going to be on southeast Alaska in general if this fishery gets shut down?
Trollers are kind of the iconic Alaska fishing vessel. The fishery has been going on since territorial days. Trollers have these tall poles that extend out, and they just cruise along gracefully over the waves, catching fish one at a time. Each king salmon, each coho salmon, every fish that they bring aboard is caught one at a time. Pound for pound, a troll-caught king salmon is the most valuable fish in Alaska. It's possible that a king salmon is more valuable to Alaska than a barrel of crude oil. and the fishery is quite lucrative. At the dock, it's worth about $15 million. Statewide, there are about 1,800 permits for salmon trolling, both power and hand troll, but only half of those permits might be fishing any given season. And once those fish are sold to the processor, and then the processor sells them, and they enter sort of the economy, that $15 million is multiplied many times over. So it's going to be a huge impact, but I don't think it's going to be the end of trolling, mainly because chum salmon has become so valuable in recent years. But it's a loss to the people who have been doing this fishery or participating in this fishery for multiple generations. And it's kind of a loss for everyone who feels that Alaska has bent over backwards to try and preserve this stock, and it's being taken away on basically a technicality.
Well, I heard you say that you're following this closely, so we will definitely stay tuned to any updates coming up. That was KCAW News Director Robert Woolsey. Rob, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Casey. I appreciate it.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an aid volunteer from Ukraine shares her experiences with Alaskans.
The shelling was pretty hard for many months.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Sexual violence affects nearly every household in America. If someone you love has experienced sexual assault or abuse, it can be a lot to handle. Reach out to the National Sexual Assault Hotline today to learn how to support someone you care about. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAINN.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
The 610-foot dock landing ship USS Harper's Ferry was in Kodiak today in town as part of Northern Edge 2023. Northern Edge is a joint training exercise with other military branches in the Gulf of Alaska. The exercise happens every 2 years and will include live fire while ships are at sea. It's been criticized by commercial fishing groups and environmentalists. Navy officials claim their impact to fish, whales, and other marine mammals will be minimal. Other operations are being conducted around the state as part of Northern Edge. That includes on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, Eielson Air Force Base, Fairbanks International Airport, and Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport. A Delta Junction couple faces federal charges of conspiracy and wire fraud for allegedly bilking investors out of more than $700,000 they thought would be used to develop a marijuana theme park in Salcha. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
FBI investigators say Brian and Candy Cordy used false and fraudulent claims to get 22 people around the country to invest a total of $722,000 in a project the Cordys referred to as a marijuana theme park they called Bud and Breakfast. According to a U.S. Attorney's Office affidavit, the Cordys enticed the people to buy shares of their company called Ice Fog Holdings to develop a marijuana cultivation, processing, and retail facility at the site of the old Midway Lodge in Salcha, which the couple bought in 2018. The affidavit says the Cordys told investigators the attraction would, quote, include glass ceilings so Ice Fog's customers could lie in bed and watch the northern lights, unquote. Fairbanks-based assistant U.S. attorney and lead prosecutor Ryan Tansey says they take investment fraud extremely seriously.
And our office, U.S. Attorney's Office, is going to use all the resources that we have to investigate and hold culpable parties accountable in cases like this.
Brian Cordy declined to comment about the case on tape, but he said in a written response to query that, quote, an indictment is merely an allegation and all defendants are presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in a court of law, unquote. Cordy allegedly told investigators beginning in mid-2017 that he expected the company's profits would grow quickly, from $3.8 million in the first year to more than $23 million after 3 years. And he said their investments would grow 30-fold. But the project never came to fruition. Investigators say the Cordys and as-yet-unnamed co-conspirators knew the business had no real revenue potential and little to no prospect of obtaining a license from the state Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. They also said the Cordys used the money from investors for personal purposes. The Cordys are scheduled to be arraigned on Monday at the federal courthouse in Fairbanks on charges that include 3 counts of wire fraud and 1 count of conspiracy to commit wire fraud. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Expert witnesses testified in court Wednesday in Ketchikan that traditional tribal values are ingrained in Southeast Native culture. They were testifying in a trial to determine if it's constitutional to display traditional tribal values in Ketchikan schools. Cultural anthropologists and professors took the stand to answer questions about what the values mean to Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people. KRBD's Reagan Miller was in court and has this report.
A trial has been ongoing in Ketchikan to determine if displaying the 14 traditional tribal values developed by area culture leaders violates the First Amendment. About a third of Ketchikan students are Alaska Native. Stephen Langdon is a professor of cultural anthropology. He testified that the values all hinge around the idea of respect, central in Southeast Native culture.
Well, what's critically important is that people have to learn to live together, and by understanding others, it's much more successful.
The idea of reverence for our Creator is what plaintiffs Justin Brees and Rebecca King say violates the First Amendment's Establishment Clause. They say that hanging the posters in school common areas without context or a lesson is endorsing the values. They also take issue with how the values are used at Ketchikan Charter School. Langdon said there isn't a religion or a specific deity worshipped by Tlingit, Haida, or Tsimshian people. He told several traditional stories from clans around the region to emphasize how the values are integral in the Native way of life. He referenced stories about the character Raven, which is both creator and trickster. He described the stories as teaching tools.
The ways in which they are used in teaching is to think about what Raven is doing, and it's not necessarily in a positive light.
But plaintiff Brees pointed out what he believed to be references to creation in Raven stories. Plaintiff Rebecca King spoke at length in court on Tuesday. On the final day, Brees highlighted a website from the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska, which makes a reference to the Creator that blessed indigenous people with the land. The site also has a passage that includes a description of the story Raven and the Creation Story, and describes it as a story about, quote, how the raven created the world. But Langdon said that he doesn't think the example was typical.
Well, it's an unusual use of the word creation from the vantage point of Western thought.
He said that the term doesn't really translate to English, and raven stories aren't creation stories. They're meant to teach lessons.
Or who Raven is supposed to be a part of.
Rosita Worrell is the president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. She testified that the meaning of the word creator got misinterpreted in translation.
In our culture, reverence for, you know, our creator, you know, doesn't refer to any god or any deity that we worship.
Worrell said that the Southeast Native culture includes a belief that everything has a spirit, even a rock or a table. She said that the values need to be taught to promote healing from historical wrongs. They are necessary to openly living a traditional way of life.
We want people to learn about our culture and our values.
In closing arguments, Brees said that the district is teaching the spiritual beliefs of indigenous people.
They are used as a guidepost for behaviors and beliefs required of a good student. Recognizing and rewarding students for following the 14 traditional tribal values shows the district is teaching, promoting, and endorsing those tribal values instead of teaching about them.
John Patasson, the attorney for the school district, argued that not every reference to a creator violates the First Amendment. He said that the values are deeply ingrained in an indigenous way of life, which has a place in public schools.
These values take on a meaning which are social and customary for these people, and it has taken on that meaning for the last 12,000 years. Every feature of everyday life, be it subsistence ceremonies and every object that the experts and all the witnesses have shown you, these are the values by which they live.
Wednesday marked the end of the civil trial in Ketchikan Superior Court. Judge Catherine Librand did not give an estimated timeline for her decision, but told the courtroom she didn't expect it to take long. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
Construction season is here, Alaska. Avoid surprises on the drive. Before getting on your way, check 511 for traffic delays. For current traffic information and road conditions, visit 511.alaska.gov or download the app or call 511. For more detailed information about DOT construction projects, visit dot.alaska.gov/construction. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
An aid group with roots in Alaska has been working to get much-needed supplies to Ukraine as that war-torn country continues to battle Russian invaders. At the end of what is now an international chain of volunteers and donors is a Ukrainian woman delivering the supplies, everything from medical kits and underwear to electrical generators and drones. Her name is Olga Shpak, and she was in Alaska this week to talk to fellow members of the Assist Ukraine group about where the supplies are going and to tell Alaskans about what she's seen as the war in Ukraine has progressed over more than a year. Before the war, Shpak worked as a whale biologist, but she was born and raised in Kharkiv, a city hit hard by Russian forces. So she knew from the beginning she had to get home to help.
Well, Kharkiv is less than 40 kilometers from Russian border. So on the first day of war, Russian tanks were on the Belt Road in Kharkiv. A couple of days later, Russian tanks would be in the city. Kharkiv was never taken, but there were battles in the city. The planes bombed Kharkiv from the first day of war. The shelling was pretty hard for many months.
And forgive me for asking this, but have people that you know been hurt, or have you lost anyone in the war?
Unfortunately, many. I've lost relatives. I've lost a really, really close friend of mine. And then because I started to volunteer from the beginning of war, I developed very close relations with many soldiers. And unfortunately, I can say that a lot of phone numbers in my phone will never be active again. I've lost a lot of people.
I'm sorry for that. And just what you've had to go through with that. When you say you started volunteering, what kind of things were you doing to assist there?
So the first day I started to volunteer, there is a tent on the central square of Kharkiv, right in front of the regional administration building. So people in the city, they knew about this place. Civilians and soldiers, and then again, a lot of people who were civilians yesterday became soldiers right on February 24. So when the war started, of course, there was a lot of panic, nothing was organized, but everyone knew that there is a place to go to. So civilians would start bringing medical supplies, clothes, food to this place, fuel. And the soldiers that were passing by, they would quickly stop, take what they needed, and go where they had to go.
Gotcha. Yeah, it sounds like it was in the beginning just kind of born out of necessity, but that as this conflict has gone on, it had to get more organized. So how did you hear about Assist Ukraine? When did that come up, and how did you get attached with that group?
It's one of those mysteries of how the networks work. So it was through someone. She was a friend of my friend who put me in touch with this girl in Alaska. And then that person said, can I bring someone else? And that was Art. And this is how we met.
So tell me more about Assist Ukraine. I understand it kind of started here in Anchorage. Is that right?
Yes, Art Davidson with his friends founded this foundation, and also Annie Gerrels, who used to be NPR correspondent for many years and worked in Russia. And then more people joined the group, and it has become international. I work on the ground in Ukraine. Now it's a wide geographically.
Yeah, that's super interesting that it's so big now. And it makes me wonder about more of the things that you're trying to collect to get to Ukraine. It sounds like it's just kind of like anything. I mean, generators, medical supplies, uniforms. What else? I mean, what kind of things are you trying to get there? Or does it just kind of depend on the day? Or
when I try to explain what I do, I'm saying, imagine Amazon. It can be from underwear and socks, and those may be urgently needed if people sit in the cellars in Bakhmut and can't change and they don't have access to water. To have clothes to change for a dry one could be crucial for them. And then it could be pickup trucks, could be Starlinks, could be drones, and anything in between, literally anything. And usually it's needed yesterday. Every time I got a phone call, it's like, we need it now.
It sounds like it can be kind of dangerous just to transport things in. A car could get shelled or something like that. I mean, that seems terrifying to think about to me. I mean, are you worried when you go in that you might get hit or killed or something?
The war is terrifying. This is the war the way you see it in the movies or wars. I don't go often to the front line, so I can't say that I'm permanently in danger. But from time to time, we do go. We need to deliver help. When the front line was closer to Kharkiv, because a huge part of Kharkiv region was occupied. Well, I'm glad the logistics is more difficult now because it means that the front line is further from Kharkiv.
What do you want Alaskans to know about either this war or the work that you're doing as you look for more help in this project? What are you telling folks?
I'm meeting a lot of people here who say when they meet me and we talk and they find out more, they ask, we want to help, but we don't know how to help. And a lot of people are reluctant just to send money to, let's say, Ukraine. You never know where this money would go to. You don't get the feedback. And it's always more satisfying to know with whom you are working. And I'm here not so much to ask for more help, but to say thank you and kind of report to them and tell them what's going on, how we used their money, whom we helped, which lives we saved.
That was Olga Shpak, director of Assist Ukraine. Find out more at assist-ukraine.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Greg Knight in Nome, Brian Venwa in Kodiak, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, and Reagan Miller in Ketchikan. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
If you've got Medicaid, make sure Medicaid has got you too by keeping your contact information up to date. Visit MedicaidRenewals.alaska.gov to use the new online form to quickly update your contact information without waiting. A current mailing address, phone number, and email address is needed to avoid delays in healthcare coverage. Plan to stay covered by visiting MedicaidRenewals.alaska.gov for information and resources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.